This is the State of Things from the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. I'm Frank Stasio. It's the first full day of the legislative short session. Lawmakers are here at the Capitol to work out the state's budget and make some adjustments to the initial budget plan they worked out last year. They do so against a backdrop of public demonstrations in support of and in opposition to the controversial House Bill 2. More on that shortly. But first, North Carolina's voter ID law stands up to a legal challenge. A federal district court judge yesterday issued a ruling that found the measure does not disproportionately burden minority voters and therefore is constitutional. Plaintiffs in the case have vowed to appeal to the Fourth Circuit Appellate Court. WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBerry is here. Welcome back, Jeff. Good
Hello,
to see you.
Frank. Nice to see you.
485-page decision, but it addressed all three parts of the law. So give us a synopsis of what it said.
Ho-hum, nothing like 485 pages at 7 o'clock on the first day of a legislative session when 54 people were arrested. Protesting a different bill that will also likely end up before this same judge. So Judge Thomas Schroeder, a nominee of George W. Bush, releases this decision last night. It deals with voter ID. It deals with early voting, which had been reduced. It deals with out-of-precinct balloting, and it deals also with other provisions within voting rights, voting access. The short of it is that the judge, conservative-leaning judge, has sided with the General Assembly leadership. The Republicans in this case, he has said that the plaintiffs being the NAACP and the ACLU, among others, failed to demonstrate with facts or data or expert testimony that this new law disproportionately burdened African Americans or Latino voters. So this law, this is just the latest step in this, really what's a long legal story. So for now, the law has been upheld. That means that after the June 7th congressional elections, early voting will be reduced. There'll be no out-of-precinct balloting. There'll be no same-day registration. Of course, this is the legal system, so there will be an appeal. This will next go to the Fourth Circuit Court in Richmond, and it is possible. Some legal experts have even leaned on it is almost likely that part of this bill could be undone when it gets to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, could then elevate to the Supreme Court. And if it goes there, it's an 8-justice Supreme Court, as many people listening know. And that would probably be deadlocked and send the verdict back down to the Fourth Circuit.
That's right. Last ruling wins in the case of a 4-4 tie. Reasonable impediment. Now, this was a key provision that actually lawmakers came back and changed here in North Carolina after the Shelby, Alabama decision suggested that maybe things had gone too far in North Carolina. They made a change here, and that may have made a difference in this particular court ruling. Tell us about the reasonable impediment ruling.
Judge Thomas Schroeder referenced that many times throughout the 485-page ruling. Spoke with Representative David Lewis, a leader in the House, House Rules Chairman today. He's a Republican out of Harnett County. What he said was he used a baseball analogy. He said that essentially what House Bill 589, that reasonable impediment legislation that moved through last summer, he said it was akin to a backstop in baseball, so that if a ball gets by the catcher, there's something there to stop it. He said what this did was it provided protection and it keeps people from losing the right to vote, from being disenfranchised. And he said that the House Bill 589 that passed last summer was very important in this case, getting the ruling it did yesterday.
All right. And the plaintiffs have said they will appeal, so we will stay tuned. Meanwhile, as you suggested, yesterday a busy day, not just in the judiciary. Lawmakers met with protests from both sides of the HB 2 debate as they signed on again for this new short session here in Raleigh. Let's hear from Republican Senator Andrew Brock yesterday on HB 2.
I was personally attacked because a newspaper reporter said when we had the special session that it would have cost $42,000 and you're a fiscal hawk. You don't like spending money. How can you justify $42,000? I said $42,000 will not cover the medical expenses to the man who walks in to the bathroom where my little girl's in there.
Well, his supporters were not the only ones there. Opponents of HB 2 were always there and also there in big numbers. The Reverend William Barber, head of the state chapter of the NAACP, also made a talk last night.
This is our moment to reject the politics of fear and division and hate. This is our time. This is our time.
Reverend William Barber, head of the state chapter of the NAACP. What happened yesterday, Jeff?
All kinds of chants, all kinds of passionate response and rhetoric on this topic of House Bill 2. The opponents to this measure gathered in front of the old Capitol. And, you know, not only were they attacking the bathroom provision, but they were talking about state recourse. They were talking about minimum wage limitations. On the other side, the proponents of this bill, they came in busloads. They came, many of them connected through churches and related to religious affiliations. They talk about just the common sense measure of this and that this really boils down to a protection or something that's been in place for a long time. Men use men's room, women use women's rooms, and this is not something that should be infringed on or taken away from.
Well, given the robust debate and the number of people out on the street on both sides, what is common in this sense, the common sense is not common to all in the state of North Carolina. The debate goes on, and of course there's a repeal measure already making its way through the House.
House Bill 946 was filed yesterday by four Democrats. This is largely symbolic. It has been moved, or it's being sent to Judiciary 4, which is a committee that will probably not meet again for several weeks. Senator Buck Newton, running for Attorney General, asked him about the chances of this repeal moving forward. He said, why don't we just have a conversation about the sun rising in the west tomorrow?
WUNC Capitol Bureau Chief Jeff DeBerry. Jeff, thank you so much.
Thanks, Frank.
Well, House Bill 2 is at the forefront of the legislative debate. Lawmakers are also here to devise a state budget. And on Friday, Governor Pat McCrory announced his $22.3 billion spending plan that represents 2.8% increase in total spending. He shared key provisions of the proposal, like the average 5% pay increase for teachers, and as well as $30 million towards substance abuse and mental health programs. No tax increases or cuts. He plans to release a full detailed budget tomorrow. I talked with State Budget Director Andrew Heath earlier today. I talked with him about the plan. I said it includes the 5% pay increase, but I said critics say it sounds good if you don't count for inflation, but if you do that, then there's a net 13% loss in the past 15 years, and I asked Budget Director Andrew Heath why the governor isn't making up for that.
Sure, that's a criticism that's often pointed out. You know, you can take a historical high watermark and adjust for inflation, but what this governor's budget does is provide a historic pay raise for teachers to get them up to the $50,000 mark in real dollars for the first time in state history. And this is really building on a commitment that the governor has shown throughout his term. He's built on teacher pay raises each time there's been a budget. He's invested over $1 billion into teacher pay since he's come in 2013, and this is just a furtherance of his commitment to teachers.
But, I mean, I wonder if it's too little too late in the sense that the state is falling way behind even southern states in terms of competition or relative pay. Shouldn't the state of North Carolina be looking for ways to make up lost ground so that it can remain competitive, falling as it has so far behind even other southern states?
I would disagree a little bit that North Carolina is falling in the national rankings. I believe that they've actually increased since Governor McCrory has come on board in 2013. I think they were as low as 46th in teacher pay, and I believe that they're now around 42nd in teacher pay, and I would anticipate moving up the rankings. And in terms of too little too late, that really, I believe, is sort of an unfair picture being painted about what's being done here. These are historic pay raises, investments of hundreds of millions of dollars into teachers, and it really shows that he cares about teachers.
Governor's budget includes more than $30 million towards mental health increases, and it'll put a few hundred people, it'll increase Medicaid rolls for in Alzheimer's treatment and other particular targeted autism, I think. Hundreds of people on the rolls, and yet close to 500,000 people were left off the rolls because of the unwillingness to expand Medicaid. That leaves a lot of uncovered North Carolinians even after the hundreds put back on the rolls. Does the governor plan to address those people who are left uncovered?
Well, what the governor's budget does is invest $80 million additional dollars into Department of Health and Human Services. And as you pointed out, that's highlighted by the $30 million that's being invested into the recommendations of his health and governor's Mental Health and Substance Use Task Force. Some really good things are being done there, as you pointed out, with Alzheimer's, caring for our elderly, helping those who have been victim of this opioid and heroin epidemic. It's providing money for drug treatment courts to try to divert people from jails and into treatment where they need to be, transitional housing for those suffering from those substance use disorders. So I think there are some really good things that this budget does. And, you know, this is the short session, so it's really an adjustment of the budget that's already been passed for the biennium.
At a press conference on Friday, the governor said that he didn't think House Bill 2 would have any impact on this budget. We've seen a lot of companies saying they're not going to bring jobs to the state as they said they would. Those are some high-paying jobs. Is it true? Will it have no impact on state growth and therefore the projections that this budget is based on?
I'll defer to the governor's office on House Bill 2, but what I can say is we need to, when we're having this conversation, it needs to be put into perspective. So North Carolina, if it were a country, would be about the 35th largest economy in the world, ahead of recognizable countries like Austria. There is a gross domestic product of over $500 billion. There are thousands of businesses in the state. Since Governor McCrory came into office in 2013, more than 275,000 jobs have been created in the private sector. And, you know, to put that into context, that's a job for every man, woman, and child in the city of Winston-Salem and New Bern combined. So we need to put that in perspective when we talk about the small number of businesses who have expressed concern about this very political issue. I do not see this issue impacting overall state revenues. Wages are up. Jobs are being created. So it's more of a political issue.
All right. Andrew Heath, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Heath is the state's Governor McCrory's budget director. Well, we're going to continue our conversation on the state of things, looking at HB2 on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. I'm Frank Stacio, and we're here in Raleigh because legislators returned to Raleigh to begin the short session to work on the budget for the next year. Controversy, of course, over HB2, the so-called bathroom law, continues. And joining me now is a panel of lawmakers. Greer Martin is a Democratic representative from Wake County. He's one of the co-sponsors of the HB2 repeal bill. Greer Martin, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
Also with us, Representative Skip Stamm, the Speaker pro tem and Republican from Wake County. Skip Stamm, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Also, Chris Groh is a Democratic representative from Guilford County and Executive Director of Equality NC. Hello, Chris. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And also Representative Chuck McGrady, a Republican from Henderson County. Welcome back to you. Good to have you back.
Glad
on the program.
To be here.
So, Greer Martin, let's start with you. You have spearheaded the effort to repeal HB2. Why?
Right, yeah, I'm pleased to join Representative Darren Jackson, Susie Hamilton, and Greg Meyer as sponsors of the repeal bill. I think it's clear from the time that House Bill 2 passed that it's having growing damage on our state's economy. The number of jobs that are either going to leave or not come, or that were going to come and are not coming, is getting into the thousands now. The bill is well into the millions, perhaps hundreds of millions, and potentially, depending on what happens with federal Title IX dollars, the cost could get into the billions. We've heard from major employers, huge job creators in our state, calling on us to repeal House Bill 2. And at the same time, we've had a cry come up from the masses also that we need to repeal House Bill 2 because of the rights that it takes away from North Carolinians.
Paul Stamm, how about that? Any chance we would repeal HB 2?
No, and let me address Representative Martin's complaint there. The bill essentially, for all practical, on this point, maintains the status quo before March 23rd. So, for example, take PayPal. We have the same law today that we had when PayPal announced a week before we changed, before we passed the law, that we had then. These folks who said they're going to take a convention away or that not, we have the same law today that we had when they scheduled their convention to start with. We also have the same law as 29 other states on matters of discrimination. And on matters of bathroom usage, we have the same law as about 10,000 other cities in America. So,
well, let me just stop you there, because
yes,
it does seem that those companies are reacting to a particular law that you passed, that you had to have a special session to pass because it wasn't on the books. And that's the thing they're reacting to. Am I right, or did I get that wrong?
They're reacting to news accounts of what was done.
But there was a law that was different now than was in place, and that's what they're reacting to. No?
No.
Not a different law. What was the special?
Charlotte.
Forgive me then.
Because yes, I'll forgive you.
I'll forgive you and explain.
Well, please do, because I'm confused about why the special session.
I'll forgive you and explain it to you.
All right, well, do both of those, because there was a special session in the new law.
On these points, yes. The city of Charlotte had passed an ordinance, right, which was to go into effect April 1,
right,
and was going to radically change the law for business, for 20,000 business owners in Charlotte. What we did on March 23 was pass a law that stopped that, maintained the status quo on matters of what is discrimination, what is not discrimination, and what had been normal bathroom usage in North Carolina and most of America for centuries.
So that thing that stopped Charlotte from doing what the voters of Charlotte wanted, that's the thing they're reacting to. That changed, and that's why those jobs aren't coming here. So what about that? Does that affect the state? If you hadn't done that, they wouldn't have said, Deutsche Bank, for instance, wouldn't say, big corporation, we're not coming to North Carolina. If you hadn't stopped Charlotte from doing what it wanted, that's a change, right? I mean, to be honest, to be fair.
Well, the reason they're doing it is not fair, because when they announced they were coming to start, and they're still here. Deutsche Bank is still here. This was an expansion.
An expansion.
We're talking about. When they came and when they announced their expansion, we had the same law that we have today. So their reason is completely bogus.
Chris Groh, what is it about this law? You are now new to the legislature. You have been an outspoken opponent of HB 2. What is it about this that you find different and objectionable?
Sure. So I don't think it's accurate that we have the same law today now that we did before what Charlotte passed. Charlotte passed a best practice ordinance that over 100 cities in the country already have in place, like Myrtle Beach in Columbia, South Carolina. Ordinances that Governor Nikki Haley there has said there's no need for a bill like House Bill 2. House Bill 2 didn't just say that we can have discrimination. It says that there must be discrimination in the use of those facilities and set an entirely new standard around what is or is not gender. So above and beyond its impact, you know, we talk a lot about the impact on bathrooms, but this also allows cities, it forces the state to say that there's no cause of action in terms of racial discrimination and employment anymore. It directly targets gay and transgender people for violence, I believe. And it strips municipalities of their ability to pass common sense ordinances.
Now, there's nothing in the language of that law that targets gay and transgender individuals, right? There's no legal requirement that they be targeted when you use a phrase like that. How does that happen?
When transgender people can't use a restroom in a public place anymore because they very clearly present as a woman and are a woman but are forced to either risk violence or go into the men's room, that is not right.
Representative McGrady, let me ask you about this. Common sense has come up often in this debate, and it is clear that there is not a common understanding, a common feeling in the state of North Carolina. We are well divided on this issue. So there is no common sense in the state of North Carolina. Is there? I mean, what do you make of the fact that it is so divisive? The fact that we can't all agree on this means that, doesn't it suggest that there's nothing common about the sense about this legislation?
I think there's a lot of common sense in North Carolina. We just don't recognize it all the time. I was not here when this whole debate went on, and so I'm coming new to the issue. And these gentlemen are much more engaged in it than I am. I'm hearing a lot from constituents and a range of people about we need to figure out some other path here. I don't think there's the political consensus to go there right now. But, you know, history of just the past year or two, both Utah and Indiana have had similar crises that involved all sorts of boycotts and whatnot going on a range of other issues. And they somehow found common ground. I don't know what that means right now. We're just one day back, and I'm talking to my colleagues and trying to understand the bill itself and the legal background. I'm not much of a lawyer anymore, so we'll see.
Greer Martin, you're one of the co-sponsors of the repeal measure. You've talked about the business implications of this, but what about the argument that, look, this is an issue that goes beyond that, that in some ways, if you believe that this is some kind of moral ground, you stand your moral ground. You don't simply look at the pressure from businesses and yield to that.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk about the economics of this, but I'm even happier to talk about the moral aspects of this. What this bill says is that the municipalities, local governments in North Carolina that had brought their citizens together through their elected representatives at the local level and decided that they wanted to protect their gay and transgender citizens from discrimination. Those ordinances are no longer in effect. The law is, in fact, very different from how it was. Added to that, we also had local ordinances in a couple places in the state that actually prevented discrimination on the basis of veteran status. House Bill 2, I think not intentionally, but certainly through gross negligence, swept those away also. So in the end, it is without a doubt a moral issue that if the citizens of North Carolina and their local governments want to ensure that their vulnerable citizens are protected from discrimination, who are we at the state level to allow our prejudices to come in and sweep those away?
Representative Stam, what about that?
Yes, Representative Martin and I are each veterans, and he had an amendment to include veterans. You know, you can always, you know, like motherhood and apple pie. And we didn't include it in the bill because guess what? We have 20 other statutes that either give preference to veterans or protect the rights of active duty military. We're the most military-friendly place in the country, and it is absolutely not true that we don't protect veterans. They're just not in that bill because they're in 20 other statutes.
There's not a single statute in North Carolina and now no local ordinances that prohibit discrimination against veterans in public accommodations. The House was offered the opportunity to vote for that and voted it down.
Well, let me ask you the larger question about whether or not the people of Charlotte, through their representative government, had the right to do what they did, and why would the state of North Carolina tell the city of Charlotte through its representative process, you can't do that?
Right. Every state has a different legal history and a different setup for state local government. The federal government is a government of delegated powers. North Carolina is one of the original colonies. Since 1835, the constitutional public policy of this state is that matters affecting trade and labor will be decided on a statewide basis and not city by city. And the city of Charlotte decided that they were going to deal with labor and trade, imposing these requirements on 20,000 businesses. The question was raised by Representative Segro about, you know, private business. Our bill does not tell private businesses how to operate their restrooms. Our bill tells cities not to tell private businesses how to operate their restrooms. Ours is much more friendly to the private sector than what Charlotte wanted to do with a very heavy hand.
That has certainly not been the opinion of the business community writ large, and that's why we're sitting here $500 million in economic loss later.
Yep. Well, what about the larger question here, though, Chris Groh? Why do you think it was important? What did Charlotte need to do that? Why did the city of Charlotte need to make those rules?
Absolutely. I think, again, it's a best practice ordinance that exists in many cities across the country, including in the Carolinas, that want to ensure that gay and transgender citizens don't face discrimination in their everyday lives. Certainly, when you have 41% of transgender people who have attempted suicide and 8% of them have been the direct subject of violence, many of them in a restroom, that doesn't mean that most people in Charlotte are out to commit discrimination against gay or transgender people, but it does mean that there are a couple of bad apples who will discriminate, and that is something that we should prevent when we're able to. The city of Charlotte overwhelmingly passed that ordinance, and its city attorney said solidly through many months of research that it is within the bounds of the city of Charlotte to ensure that its citizens don't face discrimination, and the business community was supportive of that there, including small businesses.
You've heard Representative Stam, what Chris Groh and others have said about violence against transgender people. It's increasing. We saw since this bill has passed, the suicide rates have gone up. Calls to hotlines have gone up. The sense of danger that they feel in this community because of this legislation is in some ways measurable. The danger around restrooms, the danger that you were trying to prevent, the common sense protections that you put in place seem not to be well verified. Over 200 cities in the country have such ordinances. Salt Lake City, Utah, Peoria, Illinois, Dallas, Texas, among some of them, and they have not reported any problems. Did you do any research? Do you know that this was a problem?
First of all, I have not used the safety argument. You say 200 cities. Representative Segro says 100 cities. Doesn't matter. That means there are 10,000 cities that don't have it. What is really at stake here is the loss of the sense of privacy, the expectation of privacy that the vast majority of our citizens expect when they go to a changing room, a locker room, a restroom, and that's what is being lost here.
But it doesn't seem to have affected those cities who would have had chances to change those.
How would you know?
Well, that's the point. And so we don't know because there weren't hearings here. So nobody had done the research and nobody went into those cities.
No, how would you know about the loss of expectation of privacy? It's not something you report.
I would guess it would show up at the city council.
Can I ask a question, too? Where do we think the origination of the concern over the loss of sense of privacy is coming? If it's not born out of any data that there have been any problems anywhere in the country, is it not born out of rhetoric? That's my concern, and that's the concern of the gay and transgender community. Representative Stam, let me tell you a story. I was in a town hall in Raleigh, and a mother from Holly Springs who has a transgender son said that he was well acclimated and he was adjusted well in school in Holly Springs, and that he had started to talk about the fact that he was going to kill himself. This woman was in tears. This Sunday, I took an oath to uphold liberty and justice for all, and we all took that same oath, and that includes that mother and that son. They are the ones who are at risk for violence and discrimination here. There's not this other concern is a red herring, and we need to move on from it, and we certainly need to not propel forward a narrative that's not born in data.
I spoke with a mother from Holly Springs 2 days ago whose 12-year-old daughter suffered an attempted rape in a woman's changing room within a few miles of here. Now, it wasn't a transgender person, mm-hmm. But the point is, if a person who is a male can be lawfully in a woman's restroom or changing room to scope out the place, to find out when people do, to see who's available, they are much more likely to be able to find victims than if they are unlawful to be there in the first place.
And the data is based on what? You've seen the research. It came up in the hearings. Let me ask you, Representative McGrady, about the process. This was a one-day process. There were no hearings. There was no data. There is no research to back up. No hearings with expert witnesses that would have talked about the likelihood that this has happened and all that Representative Stam has given us. There's really no data on that. And I'm wondering about the process and whether or not you think the state of North Carolina was well served in a one-day process for passing this legislation, which, by the way, went beyond what we're talking about now.
I, again, wasn't here, so I have a hard time judging the process. It was very quick, and there's plenty of precedent. When we move quickly on things, we don't always get it right. And, you know, the hard questions aren't asked in a way that they can be responded to. I don't want to be critical of you know, my constituents on that at all. I came back and I heard former Republican Governor Martin take on this, and I actually probably agree with him. I think there was a lot of overreach by what Charlotte did, and then the legislature reacted, and probably in an overbroad way. But again, that's I haven't spent enough time with it. I obviously will spend a lot of time with it in the coming days and weeks, because at some point there'll be perhaps some legislative vehicle to look at one or more of the issues that are here.
Well, some of the other issues too, Representative Stam. Why include in this bill a prohibition against cities asking their, in fact, by law requiring contractors to pay a living wage? Why do that in this bill?
Since 1835, that's been the constitutional policy of North Carolina, specifically that matters of labor, which would be minimum wage, will be decided on a statewide basis, not locally. It's similar to the advantage that the U.S. Constitution had over the Articles of Confederation, where they disallowed states and localities from interfering with interstate commerce. It's better for the economy as a whole that we decide labor, trade, also mining and manufacturing, not really relevant here, on a statewide basis. And that's been, well.
But let me just interrupt that. Yeah. If that city decided that was something they wanted to do and is in their best interest, why not let them do it?
Well, that has not been the constitutional public policy of North Carolina for 180 years.
Let me ask you, you're outnumbered. You've introduced a bill to repeal HB2. You're outnumbered. Chances of success don't look very good. But what do you think is the likelihood of success, and what happens next?
It remains to be seen. This is, as y'all would say in your business, a developing story. The pressure continues to grow. More and more corporations around the country that want to come to North Carolina because of our strengthening economy are going to make the decision not to come here. Every day we see in the news a convention that's not coming here, jobs that aren't coming here. That is not going away. So while if the vote were held today, no, certainly my bill would not pass to repeal House Bill 2. But as that pressure continues to grow and as the average citizen out there sees the jobs that are being lost, see how it's affecting their bottom line, that pressure is going to bubble up from the bottom down to their elected representatives. And I do think at some point, whether it's in the short session or in the long session, that House Bill 2 is going to get repealed. The only open question, Frank, is how much damage is going to be done to our state's economy and to our state's national and international reputation before we finally do the right thing and repeal it.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation about legislative business on the state of things, but first we will say goodbye to Greer Martin, a Democratic representative from Wake County. Greer, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
Chris Groh is a Democratic representative from Guilford County and also Executive Director of Equality NC. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
And our conversation with Chuck McGrady and Skip Stamm continues on the state of things as we look at budget priorities in the coming session. Stay with us on the state of things. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, and on today's program, we get a preview of the legislative short session. Among the top priorities, budget adjustments, taxes, teacher pay. Democrats have also filed a bill to repeal the controversial bill known, or law, in fact, known as HB2. State Representative Paul Skip Stamm is with me. He's a Republican from Wake County. Representative Chuck McGrady is here, Republican from Henderson County. And joining me now are two members of the state Senate, Senator Floyd McKissick, a Democrat who represents Durham and Granville counties. Senator McKissick, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Senator Mike Woodard, a Democrat who represents Durham, Caswell, and Person counties. Hello, Senator Woodard. Good to have you here.
Glad to be back.
Let's get back to you, Representative McGrady. We talked earlier in this program with the budget director, Andrew Heath, about the governor's priorities, mental health among them, a 5% average raise for teachers. What are your priorities, and how do you, to the extent that you know what's in the governor's package, how do you see that package faring in the House?
We broadly know what's in the governor's package. The details of that will be out this week. And then the following week, we'll get the consensus revenue numbers. And so once those two pieces fall into place, the House starts with the budget this year, and we'll go down that road. With respect to the priorities, I don't want to get too far in the weeds. I think there's consensus on the need to address compensation issues. Now, how you address that and what the scope of it is, I doubt that, you know, the governor's proposal is just going to be accepted carte blanche. There's, you know, questions about, you know, bonuses versus across-the-board pay raises, whether some group of people, whether the performance or related triggers to compensation. But that issue is front, you know, that's the top drawer issue. And I have a sense Republicans, Democrats, Senate, House are all sort of focused on that set of issues.
Well, Representative Stamm, the governor's plan does not include tax cuts. Legislature has been considering some of those. Where do you stand on tax cuts?
We have cut tax rates a lot in the last 4 years. I'm ambivalent about the latest proposed one. I'd like to see more about it, but I'm not pushing it.
Senator McKissick, what is most important to you in this year's budget adjustments? If you could set the agenda, and you can't because you're a Democrat in the Senate, but if you could, what would it be?
Well, certainly, I think the idea of providing fair compensation to our state employees is critical. They haven't gotten pay raise in many years, but for every 1% increase, it's probably going to cost us roughly about $100 million. And it looks right now, based upon revenue projections that are available, and we really won't have those numbers until another week or two, there's only about an additional $600 million in availability. Teacher pay, I think, is something that is important. It is critical. I mean, we are very low right now. I mean, the highest I've seen is shown in any of the polling that's done is somewhere around 44 out of the all of the states. So, I mean, if we can get up to that middle ground area, I mean, those are areas that are critical. Those are areas that are important. And if we could start looking at spending more money on our environment, I mean, our quality of life in North Carolina has always been high. And it's attracted many businesses to locate here. And we need to invest more in our environmental quality issues.
Senator Woodard, if we saw a report on WRAL, did an investigative report, and they came up with a statistic that showed teachers have actually fallen behind. They're 13% behind where they were 15 years ago when adjusted for inflation. We're ranked somewhere around 10 of 15 southern states in terms of teacher pay. And this budget, the governor's budget, calls for a 5% pay increase. Is that enough?
It may be in this budget, but the problem is that what we often do is we give a pay raise in election years, and then we do a bonus in the off years. We don't continue to raise the base. Likewise, we continue to raise the salary for starting teachers, but we don't do anything for our teachers' mid and late career. And that's often when our teachers are most effective, is when they've been in that school 10, 15, and 20 years. And I would say beyond teacher pay, we need to also look at other school personnel. We rank 50th in principal pay in North Carolina. And I think we would all agree, while the most important thing is the teacher who stands in front of that our children's classroom, that it's the principal who is the CEO, the chief administrator of our schools. And they keep the teachers happy. They keep all of the things running in that school. We've got to do better by other school personnel and, frankly, all state employees.
Representative Stamm?
Yes, Senator McKissick was accurate in saying that state employees have not gotten a raise to speak of since the recession. But in North Carolina, teachers are not state employees. For teachers, we've actually had an 11% increase over the last 2 years, 4% last year, 7% the year before. So one of my priorities is to make sure that state employees, who are everybody else except teachers, have some reasonable remuneration for their work.
And one thing I might point out, when I said $100 million, it was looking at state employees other than teachers and those part of our public education system. If we included those, it would be $136 million per 1% of increase. But one thing I think is critical, if we're talking about educational needs, they've gone to a new grading system for our schools in this state, and substantial numbers of our schools are getting Ds and Fs. We need to target resources, whatever it requires, to make sure that those schools are adequately performing, whether it's personnel that needs to be needs additional skill sets, whether it's the resources that they have in the classroom, whether it's part of the digital divide in terms of the students having access to the tools that are needed. We have to identify the resources that are required. We need to narrowly target it to make sure that every student in this state gets a quality education that's guaranteed underneath our state constitution.
And I think Senator McKissick makes a very important point. When I talk with teachers, I visited the schools in all three of my counties. I've talked with teachers, principals, school board members. And it's not just teacher pay. It's all the resources we commit to our public schools. Instructional resources have been lacking severely in recent years. I visited a senior high school history class, 28 students in this senior class, 16 textbooks in the class. That's a challenge. The teacher cannot send textbooks home with the kids at night to do their reading. They have to read in class. So there's the whole range of resources, and we've under-resourced our traditional public schools over the last 5 or 6 years.
Representative Stamm, the debate seems to be whether to hold taxes where they are or lower taxes. Why not raise taxes and meet all of these priorities, so state employees and teachers, so that we're not number 10 out of 15 southern states? Why not raise taxes and build the kind of infrastructure that businesses seem to be attracted to?
Even with the tax rate cuts that we've had in the last 4 years, our revenue's going up. We've gone from the 44th worst tax climate, best tax climate, to the 16th. In other words, right, we climbed 30 spots, and that's what brings a lot. It also means we've had a lot of job growth. As the last I heard, we had the second fastest job growth in the nation. Well, you don't have people wanting to come here by raising marginal rates.
Well, let me ask you, there's a couple of things embedded in that. Number one, a lot of that growth happened after the recession, so a lot of states experienced that growth. North Carolina's is a little faster than some in terms of overall rates.
Quite a bit faster.
But the growth really was from the recession to now. Interestingly enough, back when North Carolina was number 44 in tax rates, businesses were still flocking to this state. They loved North Carolina for some reason, and it wasn't the marginal tax rate that kept them away. In fact, they located here. What do you think accounts for the fact that there was so much growth over that 15-year period?
I don't think that is true. We did not have growth in net income. What you had was a lot of giveaways to specific companies that got you high rankings in Site Selection magazine. But the actual, since about 1990, the actual growth in net income was not there.
Well, one thing I might like to point out, though, when I meet with firms out in Research Triangle Park and they talk about the decrease in the corporate tax rate, what I hear from them consistently is that they'd rather not see another decrease. We're already down at 4% right now. It's scheduled to go down to 3%. They would rather see us invest and our educational infrastructure in the state so they have quality employees that are capable of performing the jobs that they have within their particular corporate communities. They want to see it invested in education. They want to see it invested in transportation infrastructure. They would rather see that occur rather than to receive a decrease of 1% or more in the corporate income tax rate. They are willing to pay their fair share. And I think the fact that we did attract such a record rate of growth in our corporate communities and throughout the entire state of North Carolina was due to the fact that we invested in our educational system. But more importantly, we had a wonderful quality of life, and we don't want to compromise any of that. And I think, the investment climate today has received a strong chill as a result of HB 2.
The current budget, though, has significant investment in a wide range of infrastructure, water infrastructure particularly, needed for small towns and municipalities across the state. My expectation is you're going to see more of that. There's no need to raise taxes here. Our revenues, we're heading where we need to be. Our revenues are coming up, and we're now in a position to invest in a range of infrastructure and in people. And I think we've already turned the ship. We just don't seem to recognize it. And I think when we get our numbers in another week or so, already we're projecting a budget surplus. I suspect it's quite possible that we'll have a little bit more, and that'll give us a little more ability to address some of the needs that are appropriately being laid out here.
So hopefully we'll have the surplus that we're all hoping for. And what that number is, I think the question comes down to how do we choose to invest that surplus? Do we continue to invest it in our people? Do we continue to invest it in health care? That's another of the things Senator McKissick's talking about, the businesses. They're also – we're in a worldwide competitive environment. We're competing for workers all over the world. And when we're looking for those best employees to come to our companies, to even small businesses that are out there competing now, the startups that we have growing by leaps and bounds in Durham and throughout the Triangle area and other parts of the state as well. These employees are looking for good schools for their children. They're looking for good health care for themselves. Perhaps they're bringing parents with them. And we got to continue to invest in those things. We got to continue to invest in the environment. I appreciate Representative McGrady mentioning some of the investments environment we're going to make. That's what they're looking for when they come here. And these marginal tax rates, I think, may matter to a CFO of a company, but they're not mattering when we're trying to invest in these employees that we're trying to attract to these companies.
Right. Six weeks ago, the people passed a $2 billion bond that will provide over half of that is for higher education, universities, community colleges, specifically for what the senators are talking about. So there'll be no lack of spending.
Well, we have, for instance, because we chose not to expand Medicaid, you've got nearly 500,000 people who are now not covered in the state of North Carolina. They don't have medical care. That's an indicator that I think often corporate CEOs are looking at. What kind of poverty rates do you have in your state? Is that something this legislature needs to address, the radically underserved people in the state?
Well, I think it's critical that we do exactly that. And, of course, there is a proposal for Medicaid reform. And we do not have Medicaid expansion as part of the proposal at this point in time. But since the Affordable Care Act was enacted, for all of those states which have gone forward, requesting waivers to change their Medicaid system, and we want to go to what they call a fully capitated system, basically involving private sector type contracts under HMO type plans. For that type of plan to be approved in Washington today, it's likely that it would require Medicaid expansion as part of the proposal. And out of about 12 states that have come forth after the Affordable Care Act, as I recall, 10 of them included Medicaid expansion or either had already started it. There was only one that was approved that did not have it, but it was imminent and being recommended as part of the proposal.
This is the short session, though, and I mean, we're talking about a long session item here. Mm-hmm. We, you know, you got to remember, we just passed a substantial Medicaid reform package. The applications for to implement that have not even been filed yet. This is a short session. Medicaid expansion is not going to be on the table this session. Is it going to be talked about between this session and the long session? I am sure it will be. But every indication from our leadership is, you know, everybody has asked us to move away from issues that are highly controversial in terms of putting forward legislation. And I, to the best of my knowledge, that's what committees meeting between the sessions have done. They've actually scaled back and said, oh, yeah, this is an important issue, but we're going to take it up in 2017.
What do you think will be the impact of the HB2 repeal effort in terms of the impact on this session in general, how long it will take, and the impact on other legislation? I'll start with you, Representative Stamm.
Very little.
We're getting ready to file the repeal bill in the Senate today, but I expect that it won't go anywhere, unfortunately. But it will continue to affect – I think it will affect the work we do. I think it will affect our ability to continue to grow North Carolina's economy and attract good workers here.
And I would simply say that a bill filed to repeal HB2 for all practical purposes is dead on arrival. It's just a matter of whether it's going to be assigned to the Rules Committee or Ways and Means. It's not likely to see the light of day. It will not receive debate. The only context in which you will see discussion formally within the chambers is if the governor's idea of tweaking the bill somehow emerges at some point in the process. And that's yet to be determined, and that could actually be just addressed as a special provision in the budget.
I want to thank all of you for being on our program today. State Senator Floyd McKissick, he's a Democrat who represents Durham and Granville counties. State Senator Mike Woodard is also a Democrat, represents Durham, Caswell, and Person counties. State Representative Chuck McGrady, a Republican from Henderson County, and State Representative Paul Skipstam, a Republican from Wake County. Thank all of you for being on the program. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much for taking your time.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. We'll have this program at our website, stateofthings.org. Information about all of our programs is there, and you can check it out anytime. State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Sheldon Ormond. Robert Copley's our technical director, and Al Wadarski helped out today. Brent Wolf, WUNC News Director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.